Chatter on Books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer. But you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to Chatter. Hope everybody had a good end of summer. We've got Claude doing all the important work. We've got David. We have to ask David about sending his youngest off to college. We've got the iconic James Grady helping us out, which is so wonderful. Jim, do not let me get through the show without reading a thank you note in which you were prominently featured. And in just a few minutes, we are going to talk to Susan Morrison, who is an icon in her own right. And she decided to tackle an amazing subject, that of Lorne Michaels. And she has this incredible book, 600 plus pages, of which I read every single one. Lorne, the Man Who Invented Saturday Night Live. Really, really fascinating. We could spend hours with her, but we won't. And this is the new and improved Fast Chatter. So first off, we got to catch up. I want to talk about iconic events in the summer. For me, it was that Coldplay couple and how that was a shared experience. But David, you sent your youngest off to college. How was it?
It was fine. It was fine. He's done all the important stuff. He's gotten COVID.
Oh my God.
Yes. So he's doing fine though. He's having a good time and he's dutifully becoming a young journalist.
And were there tears?
No.
No. When we dropped our first off, Colin, yeah. Wake Forest, it was a 5 or 6 hour drive home and I did not say a word. I was so traumatized. And then Devin's daughter, who went to Syracuse, go Orange, right. It's like, get out of the car, go, right? And then Charlie, our youngest, it was really something, because that's the, as wonderful Michael Gerson, who's gone over the Rainbow Bridge, wonderful writer, had this great line once in a piece, and he said, sending your kids off to college, it's the beginning of the rest of their lives, but it's the beginning of the end of your life.
Yeah, I know that.
So there you go.
Yeah. But no, it's just quiet. It's very quiet in the house now.
I found the biggest physical change, or the biggest whatever change in my face change, wasn't tripping over sneakers all over the place all the time.
Right.
I mean, the kids with their ginormous feet, which they inherited from their parents, were not around. We weren't tripping over sneakers as much.
Our grocery bills are a lot.
I was going to say, you're going to save a lot on the grocery bill.
That's pretty cool.
Well, I was just listening to a podcast and Bob Costas was on. It's probably, wait, tell me. And he was on. He's a Syracuse grad.
Yes, lots of people are. It's in my business.
In the water.
Like a cottage industry up there.
It is, but they produce some really good ones. So
they do. They churn them out. Mike Tirico, Marv Albert, and Ian Eagle, and I can go on and on and on and on and on.
And there's a great writer up there. Last name is Saunders, Robert Saunders, S-A-U-N-D-E-R-S. I have tried many, many times to reach him to get him on the show, and he appropriately completely ignores us, but he's a rock star. Okay, Claude,
don't
big moment
George?
In the summer.
Don't you and George Saunders? He would do your podcast.
I try to reach him, Susan, if you know.
I'm his editor. I'll write to him. Just send me a note.
We're lots of fun. Okay. Claude, highlights from the summer?
Oh, so the summer, I'm just getting used to what my house looks like. So the first week of August, I was in Memphis covering the St. Jude thing for PGA Tour Radio.
Oh, yeah.
Been in Utah. I go every year. It was Salt Lake City for... doing AV for some space satellite conference for a week, home for 2 days, and then went to New York for US Open radio, and then just got back like mid last week. So I had to put my house in the navigator to figure out how to drive there from the airport again.
Those are grueling hours at the US Open. Where do they put you up?
So, this year we were at the Westin in Flushing, and it's a new hotel. I think it just opened maybe 2 or 3 months ago. And the accommodations were great. You know, the shuttle's always fine. And, it's just, and every year they say we're going to do something about these long night matches, and they never do because people buy tickets, they buy drinks, and they buy food.
Yeah.
There's money involved. And then they're like, well, if it starts super late, maybe around 11:30 or 12, we're going to move it somewhere. No, you're not. You're not. You don't care if it ends at 2 o'clock. Money is involved. And that's what it is. You know,
a couple of our kids went one night and they bought the specialty cocktails called a honey deuce.
Uh huh.
In the cup. in the cup, which was modeled after the mint julep cups at the Kentucky Derby, by the way. And one of my kids said to me, "Oh, it was only $23," which I actually thought was kind of reasonable for those kinds of things. And he goes, "But you buy 10 of them."
Well,
So in
that's
the
the
course of,
thing. What? And all the cups are in souvenir cups for the honeydews. And then the Ace Palomas, which they had. And people, they stack them up. And so by the time they're leaving, they've got this whole stack of honeydews cups and they're just kind of stumbling their way to the train. I'm like, well, hope they had a good time because it took plenty of pictures. It's
Okay.
hard to remember
Jim
them all.
Grady, summer highlights.
I think, in a way, I'm just the opposite of what David went through. My grandson, who just became 15, came and stayed with us. And there's that moment where you realize he's not this little boy anymore. And you're staring at a teenager who's almost as tall as you, and trying to get him out of his screens to have a conversation was always difficult, but we managed, and he was in amidst all the teenage rebellion. There were these sweet little moments like, "Can I pick that up for you, Grandpa?" Or, you know, "Don't worry, I got the door. I got the door." And it's just so the family life that we all started, who knows way back when, changes with these various eras that really give us insights and moments of memory and joy. And I think that was one of my highlights. And the rest of the time it was hustling for the book that we did, American Scar that came out in July, and then hustling for one I got coming out in May called Shadows on Sidewalks, and
Excellent. We love hustles. Okay, we got to go on. Okay, I've got actually got book news, which we never do on this show. But this lovely card, if you can see it up close, came from the Toole Public Library, which is in Shelby, Montana, homestead of one Jim Grady. And this is from Heidi Alford, I believe. It's lovely handwriting, but I still can't read it. "Dear Tori, received your generous donation from Chatter to the library this week and like to thank you again for your Going Local program. What a wonderful way to enhance institutions that promote literacy, learning, and the love of books. Jim holds a special place in my heart. Whenever he gets back to Shelby, we try to get together for a visit. His mother helped me out." I felt like I was in a Hallmark movie reading this. "His mother helped me out when I took this job almost 39 years ago. She worked here prior to my employment for, I believe, 16 years. I listened to Jim's latest podcast with you. I had to chuckle when he mentioned the plays that he was in and the one he wrote. I got out the 19, I won't say it. I got out the Shelby High yearbook just to see the pictures. What a hoot. So now I'm trading emails because we want to get the pictures from that." Okay. Lightning round very quickly, and then we have to talk about our competition that we're going to start launching. Barnes and Noble announced recently they're opening 30 more stores. They're up to about 60. They will be up to about 60 by the end of 2025, first half of 2026. What are we to make? And we'll go Jim, David, Claude, Susan, jump in if you want. What are we to make of these brick and mortar traditional bookstores coming back?
I think it's a great sign for all of us here in the book and I would say even literacy and journalism world. It shows a optimism, and it also puts something out there for the members of the public who, have to go to the grocery store or have to go to do their errands. And when they see a bookstore, I think what goes through their mind is, I haven't read blank book, or I always wanted to read this book, or maybe I should stop in. I think it's a good force that has just
I
been.
agree. I agree. David?
I'm cautiously optimistic because I don't necessarily trust the motives of most corporations these days. But it is encouraging to see someone, I don't want to say turning away from progress, but going back to something we already did, right? Like, our whole notion as a country is we don't go doing things that we did 20 years ago. We find something better, a different way to do it, a more efficient way to do it. And obviously, selling books via Kindle is more efficient than opening up a big brick and mortar store and selling them that way. And so for people to say, hey, we can go back and we're going to go back to selling books the old fashioned way, I kind of like. I am very excited about that. I just hope that they stick with it.
I wonder if the books are the hook to get them in there. I was in a Barnes & Noble outside Minneapolis the other day, and I went in, as I do, to find David's book and then put it in a more prominent place. But I noticed, to your point, Jim, people are standing there talking to each other about the books they've pulled off. Or they went and maybe they went in to pretend to be looking for books, but then they sit there and they're having a conversation at the little cafe. And then they're buying some cute tchotchke to take home. But I think it. We make. I'm with David. Cautiously optimistic. Claude, last time you were in a bookstore, Claude, was probably when we taped the show in one.
Right. Yeah, for sure. That was the last time I was in a bookstore. But I will say this: I do think you're onto something, Tori. Like, yeah, they'll bring them back, but watch out for. I mean, the cafe thing is something I think that is probably necessary for any. But look out for increased. Like events, like I wouldn't be surprised if there's a store that's got a lot of space that will even have like a stage front. Has anybody ever seen like these listening parties or concerts that are all audio driven where you have these headphones, like quiet parties or something like that? Imagine audio book listening party.
Oh,
like
wow.
I just think that they're going to try to reinvent, like have another reason for people to come in other than buy the book, because you're still competing with online stuff. But I think the social aspect is one, but look out for these different kind of innovations and things like that.
I think that might be.
And by the way, I think the book people have to be okay with it, because you're going to get your bookstore, but they're also going to try to hook people in with something else. And we've got to be okay with a piece of, you know, retailer being in your bookstore or just something. I mean, to get the people in.
Yeah. Before the pandemic, we had a thing going with, I don't know if it was Chase. I don't know who it was. One of the banks, because they were setting up these little cafes trying to, you know, get people to come in and hang out. Who wants to hang out in the bank? But anyways, we were going to do regular tapings in there. Okay. All right. New idea based on our love for independent bookstores, local public libraries, and good writing. The idea is, the working title of this, and I've traded some ideas with David, with Claude, with Jim, with some others. The working title is The Pitch. And we would find 5, 6, 10, I don't know how many of them, independent bookstores, maybe the Tool Public Library, Jim, because we love it. And they nominate writers / books from their area. Try to make it as representative of the country as possible and keep it limited. We don't need 10,000 entries, because I'm going to have to bribe some people to judge this thing. But they nominate it and they come on the show. The bookstore owner or the head of the library comes on and pitches their author, their book, something in the last year or so. And then we do all of that this fall, this winter, and then we have the winners next spring. And it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but I think it's a lot if you're a struggling, aspiring writer. Hopefully that's who we attract for this. Say 5,000 for one nonfiction and 5,000 for a fiction winner. So, David, you're first. Reactions.
Love it. Great idea. I think it's a fantastic idea.
And geographically diverse, right?
Of course. You have, I don't know how many regions of the country. Maybe we could have it for each of the federal districts that we have. Is it 13? We could do it that way. I don't know. However we want to do it. So maybe do it that way. I don't know.
Jim had an idea about promoting via local radio. But Jim, what do you think?
I think it's a great idea. I think that I realized after we talked about it, not only will it help the bookstores and the writers, but more people will find out about this great show that you run.
There you go.
No, more people are going to hear about that.
Really? My retirement depends on this show. So, yeah.
No, you are going to get local and regional press. And while that isn't as big a thing as it used to be, it's still out there and it's still important.
Yeah.
And I think that it's a great idea you had.
Cool. All right. Well, more to follow on that. Anybody listening, you have ideas, email us, you know, text us, whatever. Okay, Susan, we're 2 minutes, 3 minutes late coming to you, but quick reactions to this idea about the pitch, about this writing competition, because you've seen everything. You've seen every kind of writing.
I think that's great. I mean, I think people always want to, you know about people in their community. And on that point, I'm going to jump back to what you were saying about the Barnes and Nobles. It makes me think of a thing I heard a comedian say last week, which is, you knew that fun socks were over when they started selling socks in bookstores. But I would turn that around to say that the Barnes & Noble in my neighborhood, it's the only place in my neighborhood where I can buy not only books, but I can buy art supplies, and I can buy socks, and I can buy gifts. And given that bricks and mortar stores are disappearing, the bookstores have become almost something like the old-fashioned general store, you know, and that's why people have conversations there. You know, my neighborhood, it's really hard to buy almost anything because all the stores are closed, and the Barnes & Noble has kind of picked up the slack and offers a little bit of everything.
I love that notion of them as the general store. That's perfect. Perfect. Okay, Susan Morrison, we are so happy to have you here on Chatter. This is great. And he's just an icon in the literary world. I learned recently, I knew you've been at New Yorker for 30 years.
Yeah, about 30 years.
You've seen it all, every kind of writing, good, bad, and in between. But I did not know about Spy Magazine.
Oh, yeah.
That was, is David and Claude know, Jim knows to a certain extent. I'm the youngest of five girls, and they were all really, really smart and talented, and I was not. And I used to have to sneak Spy Magazine into the house. I had to sneak it into the house because it was, my parents did not think that was appropriate. But what did you learn from Spy Magazine?
Oh, I learned everything at Spy Magazine. I mean, for those of us who started it in the beginning, I think even though we've all done interesting things since then, it was really the crucible moment in our lives where we, you know, in the 1980s, the media, especially the New York media, was so worshipful of all the junk bond kings and the charity ladies in their poof dresses. And, you know, there was no critical thinking at all. And we came out there with our idea was we were going to be biting the ankles of the overdogs, as we called them, you know, because everyone was giving them all a free ride. That's why we were so on to Donald Trump, you know, way before anybody. And we just learned that we could think for ourselves and write stories about people, even if they didn't want us to, and just get the facts right and have it be, you know, funny and incisive. And we just had a lot of fun. I mean, it's the principle of writing not for a demographic, but just writing for yourself. And, you know, enough smart people fell in line and wanted to read that it was a bigger success than any of us expected, actually.
And do you think there's some connect? We'll get to Lauren, the book, which is fantastic. Yeah. I found kind of a thread. I mean, again, it was going after the big dogs. It was being as irreverential, is that the word, as possible. That was something about what made SNL so unique, wasn't it? It was unlike.
Yes, no, it's exact. That's exactly right. I mean, what Lorne was thinking about in 1975, you know, he came out of this, he'd been working in Hollywood, working for Perry Como and Phyllis Diller and these really square variety shows that were so disconnected from the counterculture or from reality. You know, they were kind of stuck in the 50s in this Borscht Belt world, and he wanted to put what was really happening on television, you know, his generation's concern, sex and drugs and rock and roll and Watergate. And it was a similar impulse to what we wanted to do. You know, Kurt Anderson and Graydon Carter worked at Time Magazine. And I had been working at Vanity Fair. Everything we were serving up was kind of pablum. Nothing was unexpected. Nobody was really trying to get behind the scenes and show what was really going on. Right. And I think it was a very similar impulse. And I think it's one of the reasons that Lauren and I ended up kind of vibing well, you know, in our long journey of talking to each other.
10 years of vibing, by the way, people. Jim, what's the longest you've ever spent on a book?
Oh, the most was 4 years. And, I can't. Lauren is such... For all of our listeners, Lauren is not just the story of one man who was a genius, a puppeteer, a puppet at the same time. It's the story of how he helped the culture of the era, as Susan said, come into living rooms all over across the country. He helped, I want to say, free a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And Susan, you really nailed it. I mean, it was, you know.
Jim, 10 years. It took her 10 years. She got there, but it took her 10 years.
Long time.
You could have, from your perch of the New Yorker, you've seen everything, everybody, excuse me, you could have chosen any subject. Why him?
Well, 10 years ago, I watched that 40th anniversary.
We thought that was the end.
Yeah. No, I didn't think it was the end so much, but I looked at it and I thought it was so good. And, you know, I started watching in the first season when I was 15, and I just kind of couldn't believe that this one man, and a Canadian to boot, had had such an intense impact on what so many generations of Americans find funny. More than just a water cooler kind of, oh, did you see that sketch? But it almost kind of rewired the way people think. You know,
yeah.
I think without SNL, you wouldn't have the worldview of Letterman or Colbert or Jon Stewart. And this idea that we all have, which is that the world is at once something, you know, we don't have to take that seriously. It's both hilarious and awful. I mean, not yeah. that we should be apathetic, but that's kind mm-hmm. of our default worldview now. And it just wasn't before then.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, he's never talked to the press. He's hiding in plain sight. And I had the advantage of knowing him a little bit because I worked for him for a few months when I was in my 20s. So I just figured, you know, I knew a lot of his writers. I was kind of mm-hmm. well-positioned. So I just figured I would go for it. And what I did, which was strategic, is that I sold the book before I approached him about it. If I had
so smart.
Called Lorne and said, I'd like to write a book about you, he would have said, no thanks, and slammed the door. But I sold the book, yeah. not promising him. And then I went to see him in his office. And I said, Lorne, I just signed this contract to write a book about you and the show. I don't need anything from you. But if you'd like to talk to me, it'd be a richer book. And, you know, if you've read the book, you know that his least favorite thing in the world is a surprise. He likes to be in control. He's a producer. So he looked
very orderly.
He looked like he was going to have a coronary. You know, he was so freaked out. But he stayed calm and he ended up just being all in. He had no demands. He asked nothing of me. He had wanted no control. But I talked to him over 50 times and everybody in his world.
And it showed. It yeah. showed. One time, a couple years ago, there was an incredible year for the Oscars. And every category had killer people in it. You know, anyone could have won. And I reached out to Ann Hornaday. And Susan, you must know Ann Hornaday. You know, longtime yeah. Washington Post movie critic. David yes. Claude Noer, brilliant, brilliant person. And I called her up and I said, what is it about this year? You know, that there's so many, because usually there's the logical winner and then a bunch of losers.
Right.
And they were all so good. And she goes, oh, it's because of the pandemic. And I said, what are you talking about? And she goes, writers had time to rewrite and rewrite and mm-hmm. rewrite. And cinematographers had time and editors had time. She goes, because of the pandemic, so many projects were in the pipeline, had an incredible amount of time. And the 10 years you spent on this was time well spent. Let me ask one quick question, because when our kids were in elementary school, there's this whole thing when they were reading and doing work called self-to-text. And I found myself through the 600 plus pages. Listeners know, read the epilogue. It's fascinating. I found myself going, oh, I remember that show. Oh, I remember the first Saturday Night Live I saw. David, Jim, do you remember the first
yes,
one you yes. saw?
The yep. first one.
Hey, go, David.
Yes.
Was the very first one?
The first one, yeah, with the Donahue and Belushi sketch. And I remember I was 10 going, what was that?
Oh, yeah. The Wolverines. Yeah.
It's so yeah. weird.
Jim?
Well, I being a little bit older than David and Susan, I was in D.C. and I was taking some friends to see a very great movie called, and I just forgot it. It's a reggae movie.
The Harder They Come?
The Harder They Come. Thank you.
Good job.
And it was at a midnight showing. And of course, we got stoned because, you know, you should for that movie. But we got early, so we went into a bar. And I didn't have a television. And I walk in, the bar is full and silent. No one is talking. No one is doing anything. They're all looking up at the TV. And on the TV, I heard them announce the battle of the TNA battle of the network stars. And it was this skit that was coming. But I thought, this is the news that's on right now. That was, and somebody said, man, it's this new show called Saturday. And the person next to him said, Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. Yeah. So mine was coming home from, I was in high school, underage drinking. A bunch of us came home to my house and we turned on the television and Simon and Garfunkel were singing. Yeah. And they were singing Bridge Over Troubled Water, just a beautiful song. And right. And then we're like, what is this? It was like, what? This is different. This is absolutely different. But Susan, explain the structure of the book because I loved it because it was so smart. You know, one, it's Monday, it's Tuesday, what happens? And it just created this pace. And it just made me want, I just kept hurtling through it going, I want to read more and more because
well,
I want to get to Wednesday
thank you.
And
That
Thursday.
was kind of a lucky accident. You know,
I doubt that. I doubt that.
I've been working on researching the book and talking to Lauren, and I realized, you know, as an editor, I thought one of the biographers' burdens is you want to avoid your story just seeming like a death march through the years. You know, 1995 turned into 1996.
1940s Canada, not a barrel of
And so, and I also knew starting in 1940s Canada would be kind of boring and chilly. So, and I needed a way so that the reader understood from the very beginning what kind of a weird guru, like mind-bendingly strange character Lauren is to the people who work for him. So after interviewing him a lot of times, I said, Lauren, I would love to, you know, just shadow you for a week of the show, really be at your elbow. And I also knew as a magazine editor that those kinds of scenes, those kinds of pieces of writing in any piece of journalism where you're in the room with someone, you're seeing them, hearing them, smelling them, getting a sense of what the place is like, is much more vivid. So I spent that whole week there. He was very welcoming, never told me, you know, never kicked me out during a meeting or anything. I got to see everything.
Great.
Then I just wrote the chapters as individual days. And that's when I had this eureka idea that I would intersperse them with a biography. And it was this sort of
great
narrative.
Better to be lucky than smart, because that was really,
it
really
wasn't
good.
Completely, it just fell into my lap that way.
Yeah. But and for the legions of 20-somethings listening to this podcast, there's millions of them. One of my 20-somethings, and almost like something is cringy. Jonah Hill was the host that week. And there are some moments where, again, people, this is one of the most inside, you know, fly on the wall experiences you will have reading a book. But there were things there where you go, oh, this is not going to go well for Jonah. I just know it's not. Oh,
but you could see it in the beginning, right?
You can see it from the very first interaction.
No, that was the most interesting thing for me. And to see how Lorne, like an orchestra conductor, just changes his modulation day by day by day. You know, the host is never more powerful than on the first day of the week when they're all trying to make him seem so confident. But then that chips away. And by Saturday, it's pretty much shut up, Jonah, you know.
Which I think, okay, that's a great segue to this question. Talk about how Lorne Michaels was probably the first one and probably still the biggest proponent of writers. He
yes,
had an experience
that
on
is
Laugh-In.
One of my favorite things about what I learned about him. And so at SNL, compared to any other television show, the writer is king. Now, I often say that Lorne kind of turned on its head, you know, the old Hollywood joke about the starlet who was so stupid that she slept with a screenwriter, right? So at SNL, the writer is the person with the power. And that happened because he had a job at Laugh-In before SNL, which was a hit show. And he thought he was not going to be on Easy Street there. But the writers were treated like crap. You know, they wrote out of a motel room miles away from the action. They never met the stars. They had no input. They didn't even know if any of their material was going to be used until the show aired. So he vowed that when he had his own show, the writers would be the heart, you know, beating heart of it. And as even with when he started SNL, he spent three times longer choosing and hiring the writers than he did the cast.
Didn't he almost need the cast, not an afterthought, but he thought, well, first of all, I thought the writing, but he thought the musical stars, he thought the hosts were going to be the big stars, right?
Yeah, and if you look at the first couple of episodes, the ensemble cast, you know, Chevy and all those people, they're only on stage for like 11 minutes. You know, they were conceived almost as background characters. But the writer thing has persisted. And at SNL, when you write a sketch, you don't just write it. You choose the costumes, you work on the sets, you direct it, you do the blocking. And you have complete ownership of it. And that's one reason why SNL produces so many people who go on to be directors and producers and showrunners. It's why you have Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and Greg Daniels from The Office. Mm-hmm. They learn how to do all of it. And I mean, as an editor, it was an exciting thing to recognize writers being valued, because there aren't too many places in our society where writers are valued.
Again, the whole Jonah Hill thing, the beginning of the week, Jonah thinks he's important. By the end of the week, he knows he's just the meat going out there. Okay, I've got one quick one. And then Jim, and then David, over to you. You talk about the early cast members like Gilda Radner, like Belushi, being exotic. And I remember that those first early shows when I watched, going, okay, they are different. And we don't see people like them on TV. Does that continue today, do you think?
Well, it does, but it's interesting. It's kind of come full circle. When Lauren first hired these people, he wanted them to be, exotic looking and ethnic looking. And it was the network that was happy that he finally, brought in Jane Curtin. Like, oh, good, a blonde cheerleader type. The middle of the country will relate to Jane. And if, I would say starting in the late 90s, Lorne came under fire for the show being having a terrible record on diversity. They have very few black players, very few black writers or writers of any other ethnicity, and he always defended himself by saying, I don't use that those kind of criteria. Just if the person's funny, I hire them. And I think he thought that that would do, and it sort of served him well for a certain number of years. And then, he is in touch with the culture, but I think it probably came 5 years too late. Finally, maybe 10 years ago, he realized, oh, wait a minute, I do have to take some extraordinary measures and make sure that my cast is more representative of the American population. And he did an unusual thing, and he called an audition in the middle of the season. I think was it 2017. Auditioned 20 black actresses and brought in Leslie Jones, and ever since then, it's like, sort of like the he sort of realized it was a eureka moment. And I think ever since then, the cast and the staff overall has been much more diverse. But he did come late to it. He wasn't paying enough attention to it early on.
Not the only one. David, you first, then Jim. Going alphabetical order.
Well, we're kind of just kind of went over some of that material because there's so many people. I mean, I remember, and it's backed up by facts. Chris Rock saying if he was in a sketch about something, there wouldn't be another sketch with another black person in the next sketch. So it was very much, okay, here's the sketch for this week, and then we're going to move on. I do think when he made Tina Fey head writer and they did Weekend Update with Amy Poehler, I think that may have been like a real turning point, maybe, where things started to get a little bit more small d democratic. And I just wonder if he felt like it was the right thing to do, or if it was just the thing that he was being criticized for and he had to do it.
I suspect that he doesn't actually hop to it when people criticize him. He kind of lets it roll off his back. But I think he did finally just recognize, like, oh, they're right. He was getting criticized, but I think it did sink in because he is the kind of person, I think if I use the phrase somewhere in the book, that when the network would be on his back about something, he's sort of like somebody who turns into a skid, driving. He doesn't listen to the criticism. I think in this case, also his kids were, he had kids. He was just getting a little more worldly in a certain way.
They had
But I
an
don't think,
influence on the music
yeah,
because
in
of
the
him,
music
right?
business, of course. Yeah, all these things. Yeah, I mean, Chris Rock is so intelligent about this stuff. I mean, he said to me, yeah, nobody ever made me play Hattie McDaniels. He didn't, but he did recognize, what he said is, I realized when I was there that SNL was, in its heart, a white show. Like Boston is a white city. So he said he figured that he would just get what he could get out of it. It was a good learning opportunity and then move on where he could do his own thing. But he said that the way you could see it is that they were really behind the curve on black artists. Like with white artists, you'd have Nirvana on right in the beginning. When they finally had on MC Hammer, it was when he was already on the way down,
Interesting.
And I think you're probably right that the music changing is one of the things that must have woken him up.
Interesting. Jim Grady?
One of the great insights in your book, Susan, that you made is how Saturday Night Live and Lorne took the culture that was of the major media, especially television, and changed it. And it did so by becoming something new. What I'm wondering is, are you seeing any kind of forces out there now? I mean, we've just entered into
Great question.
the internet era, and I keep looking for the changes that will be speaking culturally to everybody, not just, a small group of these guys are gamers, these guys are Twitters, these guys are doing TikTok. But is there any unifying central cultural entertainment force that you see coming out today and hopefully tomorrow?
Well, I think that it's the nature of the new technology is that everything is much more siloed. Like, it's interesting that, you know, Lorne thought of himself as a, you know, they didn't have the word disruptor then, but, you know, it was kind of revolutionary. Right. And now all of the young people think of SNL as just this corporate, stodgy corporate thing. I mean, I do think that just in terms of talent, you know, you hear producers and directors and people saying that they are discovering, you know, amazing talent on TikTok. But that's not exactly what you're asking. I mean, I don't think, in the same way there isn't like appointment television, you know, there isn't anything that everybody watches. I just don't know. I mean, the Super Bowl halftime show. I mean, what is there that everybody watches? It's hard to think of anything. You know, Lorne always talks about how he loved broadcast television, you know, more than cable, more than like, you know, niche things, because it reminded him of what the railroads did in the United States in the late 19th century. They brought the country together on, you know, brought everybody closer. And broadcast did that. But we're kind of in an age where everyone's just being splintered and pushed farther and farther apart. Terrifying.
I can bring anything around full circle. We've already extended the time. I promise Susan, this is why I love Coldplay couple thing, shared experiences.
Yes.
We used to have shared experiences. We used to have three broadcasts. Used to have shared experience, or the water cooler effect on Monday morning. Oh my God, what do you, shared experiences. Every person I know in every walk of life, size, shape, age, sex, right, whatever they did, that Coldplay couple thing, we're like, oh my God, did you see that? What do you think? The shared experiences are very, very rare. But when they occur, I think they're great. I think SNL still has a pretty good shared experience. I do.
Well, Amy Poehler has this funny line that I quote in the book, which said, you know, SNL, you know, the radical show that my parents used to like watch while they were having sex. You know, now I watch it on my work computer the next day while I eat my sandwich, you know.
Yeah.
But I think that because it can be broken into little bites, people are watching a couple minutes on the subway, or they're watching it.
Yeah.
You know, so in a way,
my husband
it's
Sunday,
the new technology.
Sunday mornings, my husband and I like ships passing the night, but Sunday mornings, if we're together, we watch the highlights. Okay,
yeah,
we have to do this quickly.
I watch it too. I don't stay up that late.
Sometimes we do. Okay, going local, Susan, talk about the Palisades Library.
Oh, well, I have a little house up in Rockland County, and the Palisades Library is this beautiful little community library that is not only a wonderful space with a great collection, but they do these great nights where authors come and talk about their books, and it just brings all different kinds of people from the community. It's a very, very vital little hub in this
nice
small town of Palisades, New York. And, you know, I had for years, I would go there and rent videos. That's how old I am for my children, and DVDs. And it's just nice to, you know, now that I don't have grandchildren yet, but I'm in that age group, and to still have a connection with this library, which is doing so much to kind of connect with the
It's the community thing.
Yeah.
We've talked about Jim's favorite is the tool, public library.
Now, if only they sold socks, it would be.
Hey, Chatterheads, it's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. So download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, you know, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
Okay, really unfair. After everything you know from Saturday Night Live, your favorite host or cast member? And people, by the way, again, people, this is the best fly on the wall experience you will ever have reading the book. People were so happy to talk to you.
Oh, yeah. They all had a lot to say. They're all intelligent. And
I was going to say very, very
funny.
Smart.
Yeah. You know, that's the thing. When you're a journalist, you're used to a third of your interviews kind of being duds. But all of these people, they're what, you know, my old friend and one of my writers, Lillian Ross, used to call good talkers. They could all talk.
I think
my favorite cast member might be Phil Hartman, who is just
the glue.
Nice. Over the Rainbow Bridge. Okay, we'll wrap up with that very quickly. Claude's too young for this. Claude, if you have a favorite Saturday Night Live cast member, tell us. But probably not.
I have favorite skits. Like, I love when they do Black Jeopardy.
Love that.
Oh, that's one.
Really good. Tom Hanks on Black Jeopardy.
It's really good. It's really good.
Okay,
I love when one of the characters were acting like, it wasn't Chris Rock. It was, gosh, I can't remember his name now. But he was actually one of the other characters. It was funny.
Okay, David?
It's a tie. Dan Aykroyd, I believe one of his old girlfriend said that his epiphany was he would love to be a cop and arrest himself. That was the thing.
Exactly.
More than anything else. And Eddie Murphy, of course, you know, and the greatest sketch of all time is the killing of buckwheat. That was, it's just, it satirizes everything. It satirizes television. It satirizes everything in an incredible way.
Okay. You should look up on YouTube another great Eddie Murphy sketch that I think is often overlooked called White Like Me.
Oh, yeah. No,
I love it.
I've seen that many times too.
Okay, Jim Grady, favorite?
My favorite cast member was Belushi. There was there was something gravitational about him that pulled you in, and when he'd come on the screen, you would be waiting. And I loved all the other choices everyone here has. I would have thrown in Chevy Chase too, but for me, John Belushi.
Yeah, you didn't want him to go off the screen.
Right, exactly.
Okay, people don't remember this, and I put my hands up like this to demonstrate. When they did the thing with the lobster, save Larry or kill Larry?
Oh, yes.
And it was a real lobster. It was an 800 number. And I remember, again, I'm sure it was with my friends from high school. I'm sure we're underage drinking. Just going, oh, my God. It's the best.
By the way, was that piece The White Darkness that you were referring to?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. There you go. Good job, Claude. Yep. Okay, Susan Morrison, we kept you longer than I said, but it was spectacular. We encourage everybody, go buy this book, Lorne, The Man Who Invented Saturday Night Live. Preferably at your favorite independent bookstore. It's fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. I drove people crazy the last 2 weeks, Susan, telling people stories from the book.
Thank you. This was awfully fun. This is really enjoyable, you guys. Thank you.
It is. We do have fun. Hit up Saunders for us. We'd love to have him on.
I will. Send me a note. Yeah, he's a super busy guy, but he plays. He puts out. So
yeah. Okay. And we need that. Claude, thank you. David, love you, honey. I love you all. Jim, thank you so much. We will see everybody soon. The new and improved in Fast Chatter. Thanks, guys.
Nice to meet everybody.
Yes. Nice to meet you, Susan. Take care.
Great book.
Bye-bye.